approach unless you think something else besides the global pandemic has been causing a big spike in deaths over the past 2 years. NBC News tells us the same story from a different angle. COVID deaths are unevenly distributed among Republicans and Democrats. Average excess death rates in Florida and Ohio were 76% higher among Republicans than Democrats between March of 2020 and December of 2021, according to a working paper released last month by the National Bureau of Economic Research. Excess deaths refer to deaths above what you would be anticipated based on historical trends. A study in June published in Health Affairs similarly found that counties with a Republican majority had a greater share of COVID deaths through to October of 2021, relative to majority Democratic counties. But experts are still puzzling over why these differences exist. Are lower vaccination rates among Republicans responsible? Or did the use of face masks and social distancing guidelines prevent more deaths in counties run by Democrats? The Yale University researchers behind the new working paper say vaccine hesitancy among Republicans may be the biggest culprit. In the counties where a large share of the population is getting vaccinated, we see a much smaller gap between Republicans and Democrats, said Jacob Wallace, an author of the new study and an assistant professor of health policy at the Yale University School of Public Health. Indeed, Jacob Wallace's paper found that the partisan gap in the deaths widened between April and December of 2021, after all adults became eligible for COVID vaccines. Excess death rates in Florida and Ohio were 153% higher among Republicans than Democrats during that time period, the paper showed. We really don't see a big divide until after vaccines become widely available in our two states, Jacob Wallace said. But the study suggested that COVID vaccine uptake explained just 10% of the partisan gap in the deaths. Those researchers suggested that compliance with other public health measures such as wearing face masks and social distancing was a significant factor. Vaccination does play a role in the difference that we've observed in excess mortality between red and blue states, but it is not the whole story, said Neil J. Siegel, an author of the study and an assistant professor of health policy and management at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. When you have less transmission, you have fewer cases and you have less mortality, and you have less transmission in general by instituting protective policies like wearing face masks when we had them or capacity limits in business, he added. Both papers come with limitations. The study from Siegel's team looked at counties, not individuals, which makes it difficult to determine whether other demographic factors such as education level, proximity to healthcare services, or the share of older residents played a role in the trend. The new Yale University paper, by contrast, linked political affiliation to excess COVID deaths at the individual level.
Well, dear listeners, here we interrupt the normal course of our program to have the live coverage of President Sayed Ebrahim Raisi at the 36th International Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. Let's take a listen.
Provides the person with strength, so much so that it will enable the person to resist cultural onslaughts as well as prescriptions offered by the West and the East that are not in congruity with a religious-oriented life. This gathering brings about a common understanding amongst all the influential personalities in the world of Islam. A common understanding of the assets we have at our disposal, known as religion and religious values. That is a major asset that we have, known as Muslims. And those who have faith in religion, we have a big asset known as Islamic lands at the disposal of Muslims today, with its rich material and spiritual assets. We have the youths that have faith in religion and spirituality that exists in the Muslim world, and also the spirit of resistance and steadfastness in the face of the enemy, and also preparedness in order to have a religious-based life, and also another great asset we have, that is the scholars from universities and seminaries to share views in the face of the atheistic view of life and the secular view of, to resist the atheistic and secular way of life, and to share views to see how can one resist the extremist and takfiri point of view, to share views, to learn more about their assets and their possessions, and the men and women who are prepared to get united in the name of religion and defeat the enemies, disappoint the enemies, to share views, to learn more about the position of the enemy, to see what the enemy has and what tactics have been used by the enemy in order to make us forget about our positions and assets. And the tactics used by the enemy to undermine our positions and at the same time magnify its failures, to think and share views, to see in the contemporary world today the flag that was hoisted by the late Imam, that's been the banner of unity amongst all Muslims throughout the world, with different languages in all geographical areas, with the diverse views that exist. You see that today Muslims enjoy ample commonalities in the face of the matters that may cause disunity and discord. So these commonalities are crystal clear that has brought us together and can create a major strength throughout the world, and also create a civility and a great civilization in the world in the name of religion. And such a civilization can claim that we enjoy a civility in the face of all the civilizations today. We can speak and have our own model and method for the lifestyle for the contemporary human being. And this is the point that is a common understanding amongst all these scholars in this gathering. And that is the philosophy behind the 36th Unity Conference in this venue in the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's the message it conveys to all Muslims. And its message for the enemies is that we want to form and shape the life of the contemporary human being in the name of religion. The martyrs have brought about awakening. Those who thought that religion is something related to every individual and it has nothing to do with culture, politics, and so on. But due to the blessings brought about by the blood of martyrs, you can see Islamic awakening created in all geographical areas and zones. Today, all Muslims throughout the world want to live as a Muslim. They want to live a life based on Islamic principles. And what the enemy fears today is this very issue. After World War I and World War II, and the two Western and Eastern blocs created, and after the disintegration of the former Soviet Union and the creation of unilateralism in the world, what actually has urged them to hatch plots against Muslims is that in their think tanks and in the course of their researches, they are thinking about the obstacles that can resist unilateralism. After studies, they came to the conclusion that the only power that can proudly resist in the face of the hegemonic system is only Islam. And those who have pure faith in Islam and religion, the enemies have designed schemes to see how they can counter Islam, this major power, what is focal point in Iran, in Islamic Iran. And that has been created by a supreme jurist. And the enemies want to prevent this from creating awakening in the world. One, the dependent regimes in Islamic lands. Two, the media empire in order to tarnish the Muslims. And three, creating takfiri groups amongst Muslims to cause massacre amongst Muslims. Four, insulting sanctities and the Prophet of Islam and religious sanctities. The spread of extremist way of thinking and the takfiri way of thinking. These are all parts of the very same chain, that is to create discord and disunity amongst Muslims. Putting emphasis on the points of discord and preventing the spread of commonalities amongst Muslims. They decided to prevent the growth and spread of Islam. This gathering can play an influential role. Ladies and gentlemen, the role of ulama and scholars and influential figures and those contributing to future world and history, their role is unique. Today, unity is not a it's not a tactic for us. It's a major strategy. Imam Khamenei, who has created insight for all of us, he has always emphasized this strategy as an inevitable necessity in the world of Islam. Today, unity and resorting to the divine court is an inevitable need and necessity. That's the meaning of this statement. And it can be translated that every person in every place, by his pen, his remarks, his words, his deeds, who helps the unity of the world of Islam, he is treading the path of the unity of the world of Islam. Every person, wantedly or unwantedly, knowingly or unknowingly, who through his words and deeds, who creates discord in the world of Islam, such a person is moving in the path of the enemy. This is the meaning of this statement, and this is an inevitable and important necessity that must exist. And we see the spread of Islamophobia. See what the enemies have done. For the sake of Islamophobia, they spread the trend of terrorism and many seditions and plots that were hatched in the world of Islam. But what foiled their plots was the need to strengthen unity and integrity and detecting the enemy and countering the enemy. What foiled the plots was the point emphasized insight in religion. A person who has no insight, that's a person, that's an emphasis on person's farsightedness and insightfulness. Our martyrs have played an influential role for the sake of creating insight and enhancing one's insight. And today the role of ulema and scholars is to enhance the insight of every person and make use of different methods in order to actually engage in the jihad to delineate the facts as stipulated by our leader. So, to shed light on the status and position of Islam, and also enlighten the people about the failures of the enemy. To say that despite the claims made by the enemy is disappointed. The enemy seeks to show itself as having logic and capabilities, but logic, argumentation, and a strong proof will not be influential because the evil has dominated the enemies and they cannot see and they cannot understand logic. The solution is steadfastness and resistance. Those who thought that one can save Palestine at the negotiation table and thought that by making statements and negotiating with those who have no logic, they have made a mistake. The compromise with the Zionist regime has failed, and resistance has emerged victorious. The Sharm el-Sheikh, the Oslo Accords, and Camp David Accord, did they make any breakthrough? Did they believe in these accords and treaties? They have breached their promises. The Zionist regime knows nothing about treaties and promises. If they had faith in their accords, they would remain loyal. What should one do in the face of those breaching their promises? The logic calls for resistance. What our dear Palestinians and Lebanese did, the Palestinian groups, the Lebanese groups, the Hezbollah, Hamas, and other resistance groups today, they are offering initiatives. In the past, the so-called liberation organizations had the initiative, but the message of the Islamic Revolution is the message of resistance in the face of the enemies. And it proved to be a success. In the course of the 22-day conflict and the 8-day conflict and what happened to Gaza and Lebanon, they learned that the only solution is resistance in the face of the Zionist regime. Because the Zionists know no logic. They do not believe in logic and negotiations. So today, by reliance on our assets, one can resist them. In addition to the policy of supporting the resistance groups in the world of Islam, we give priority to relations with Muslims in our foreign policy. We are working with neighboring states. We are working with neighboring countries. And we are cooperating with them in economic, cultural, and social activities. We give priority to Muslims with respect to the type of relationship. So the Muslim countries, neighboring countries, they are our priority in relationships. And in our talks, we say that normalization of ties will not bring about security for the Zionist regime. They think that through such acts of normalization with shaky elements. It's not normalization with nations. There's a difference between these two. Do the peoples of these countries accept normalization? No, never. Muslim nations in the region have not accepted and will not accept normalization with the Zionist regime. Those who are killing children, killing women, and demolishing homes and have created a big prison known as Gaza. The Muslim nations will never accept this. And the Americans and the Zionists think that this will bring about security. It will never bring about security for them. They want to impose their wishes on nations. They are pursuing the path of creating division, and they want to sell their arms and weaponry. That's being pursued by American and Western companies. They want to plunder the wealth of nations. They want to marginalize the issue of Palestine and the Holy Quds as the top priority issue in the world of Islam. Today, the Holy Quds and Palestine is the top priority matter of the world of Islam and Muslims. If the Day of Quds exists, is aimed at reflecting views, and the Muslims always think about liberation of Quds, and that's the path pursued by Muslims. The Islamic Republic of Iran and its policy opposes tyranny, opposes terrorism, opposes takfiri groups, and that's been a main issue in its policy. And the enemy's grudge is due to the very same reason. They are claiming to counter terrorism, but every person knows very well that the anti-terror hero in the region and the world is Haj Qasem Soleimani, and also Mr. Al-Mohandes, and many combatant groups in the region that managed to eliminate Daesh in this region. The Americans said in the presidential campaigns, they officially said that Daesh was created by the Americans. That was confessed by the Americans, that they created this terrorist current. The anti-terror commander, Haj Qasem Soleimani, why was he martyred? Every person knows very well that what the enemies do is defending the terrorists, and those who claim to be the advocates of human rights, they are in a position that actually oppose human rights, and they are the biggest, and the Americans, the Zionists, and some Western countries, they are the biggest violators of human rights, and they claim to be the advocates of human rights. They are the biggest violators of the rights of human beings. Take a look at their past record. See what they have done with their people, what they are doing with the world people, for what they have done with Palestine in the past 70 years. They are the biggest violators of human rights. So there's going to be a long petition about the criminalities they have perpetrated against humanity. And today, the scholars must raise awareness despite the media empire by the enemy. See what crimes they are perpetrating against humanity, and then they claim to be advocates of human rights. Common understanding in this gathering can definitely bring about sustainable peace in the region and the Muslim countries. It can bring about sustainable security, peace and tranquility are contingent upon common understanding amongst Muslims and unity amongst Muslims. Common understanding is of paramount importance to learn about one's positions and assets. It's important to review these assets, and also religious commonalities must be pursued. We shouldn't just, we should boost dialogue amongst religions and dialogue amongst people with different ways of thinking, and the Shiites, the Sunnis, they have always emphasized such dialogue. Such dialogue can address many differences and at the same time put emphasis on commonalities. So I have two concluding points. One, cooperation not just in cultural areas, but also cooperation in political and economic areas. That's a necessity to just have cooperation with Muslims. We're going to just follow up such contacts and cooperation and making use of our belongings and what we possess today. The second point that we should always emphasize is that in this gathering, emphasis must be put on what is considered as a necessity in the world of Islam today, that is, maintaining unity amongst all Muslims, and also there should be scientific and research gatherings and forums in order to address differences, and also by avoiding bigotries, in fact, one can continue to have such sharing of views, and the love of the Prophet's household, the Ahlul Bayt, can be a focal point for boosting unity amongst Muslims. I can refer to Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, and his tradition and the proximity approach that is emphasized. You can see this in the remarks made by Imam Sadiq, and also you can see signs of proximity in the tradition of the infallible imams. The proximity way of thinking can help us make progress, and the takfiri point of view is quite detrimental and dangerous, so such gatherings must spread the proximity school of thought and boost the proximity school of thought and encourage all people to pursue this approach, and at the same time inform the people about the dangers and threats posed by takfiri currents. Such currents must be removed, and this can be done through your thoughts and the influence of scholars. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to attend this conference today, and I hope that this would be a fruitful gathering in order to adopt the necessary decisions and the take practical action with regard to these decisions. I would like to thank the president. I would like to invite the president
Well, dear listeners, what you heard was President Dr. Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi addressing the 36th International Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. During this speech, Dr. Raisi said, we have important spiritual assets in Muslim countries, including spirit of resistance. Dr. Raisi said Muslims have ample commonalities to bring them together, adding, the only power which can confront hegemonic system is Islam. Iranian president said hegemonic powers seek to tarnish Islam through creating extremist takfiri groups. He said takfiri groups created in order to spawn disunity among Muslims. Dr. Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi said unity among Muslims is not a tactic but a strategy, adding unity among Muslims thwarted seditions and plots. President Raisi said normalization with the Zionist regime has failed, and a solution to problems of Muslims lies in steadfastness and resistance. President Raisi said Palestinians realize that resistance is their only solution. The Iranian president said normalization with the Zionist regime will not bring security. He said West wants to plunder wealth of Muslims and marginalize the issue of Palestine. Also, Dr. Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi said the heroes in fight against terrorism are General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Dr. Raisi said Americans are the biggest violators of human rights. The Iranian president added, most important issue is boosting dialogue among religions and Islamic sects. Dear listeners, many thanks for being with us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing European security polarization and the new Cold War against Russia with Professor Heinz Gettner from the University of Vienna. But first, this brief analysis.
Decades of aggressive eastward expansion by US-led NATO towards the borders of the Russian Federation following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the aftershocks of the Russian invasion of Ukraine have led to a dramatic security polarization in Europe, not seen since the height of the Cold War in the mid-20th century. The dreams of a borderless Europe from the Ural Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean seem very naive these days, as a hard border is being established between the Russian Federation and neighboring European countries, with a dramatic increase in the level of militarization on both sides, which, if history is to be guide, will not be dismantled very quickly once it's firmly established. Even the previously non-aligned countries of Sweden and Finland have joined NATO. It seems the old British plan of preventing a strategic alignment between Russia and Europe, and particularly between Russia and Germany, is once again being implemented. However, this time this effort is being led by Britain's American cousins, who inherited the British Empire following World War II. It's precisely in the period of the so-called American unipolar moment in the late 1990s and early 21st century, where the world witnessed the aggressive expansion of NATO towards the western borders of Russia. The instrumentalization of Ukraine, the weaponization of Ukrainian nationalism against Russia and Russian speakers in Ukraine, and the threat of Ukrainian NATO membership was the final straw and repeatedly stated red line that pushed Russia to take preemptive military action against NATO expansion into Ukraine. The severe reactions and sanctions by the Western countries against Russia have led Russia to strategically reorient itself towards the east and southeast, towards China and Iran. This has been very beneficial for Eurasian integration and particularly for boosting Iran-Russia relations, and it represents a very significant historic and geostrategic shift. But the question remains whether it's in the national interests of European countries to have bad political and economic relations with Russia. Is it really in the interests of many European nations to sanction and vilify their most important energy and raw material supplier and one of their largest export markets? Despite historically high inflation, the threat of closure of major industries, and exponential rises in energy costs, brainwashed Atlanticist European elites continue to repeat the anti-Russian propaganda designed in US and NATO think tanks, contrary to what many of the citizens believe, which is neutrality and non-alignment based on the real, tangible interests of nations. Of course, the people of Europe have so far received their reply from their elites. As, for example, when the young, inexperienced German foreign minister proudly announced that helping Ukraine is more important than what German voters want. It remains to be seen how she and her party will fare the next time German voters get to vote on what they want. Cracks are already appearing in the European facade as nations such as Hungary and Serbia are trying to take an independent position based on their national interests vis-a-vis Russia, as well as countries such as Austria, who are warning about the consequences of unilateral energy sanctions and trying to moderate the anti-Russian rhetoric. But in general, it seems that nearly all European elites have once again shown their geopolitical impotence and inability to form policies independent from US and NATO diktats. As we head into this year's cold winter in Europe, we will have to see how much the European people are willing to sacrifice from their high standards of living in the pursuit of this new cold war against Russia, which has divided Europe and forced a major historic and geopolitical realignment in the world, and which, contrary to US and NATO propaganda, does not appear to be in Europe's long-term interests.
Professor Heinz Gärtner, Professor of Political Science, University of Vienna, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
You're welcome.
When we heard that you're coming to Tehran, we asked you to come join us in person for this interview. You kindly replied to this request, so here we are. We want to talk, as you know, the program Insight is really a program where we try to look at things strategically. We try to get a deeper understanding of what's going on. And one of the major issues of the world today is what the events that are happening in Europe, particularly the events that have now occurred with the war in Ukraine. And it seems that there is a new security architecture, a new security structure, a new reality that has descended upon Europe, a reality which in many ways is very similar to the Cold War. You have this hard border again being drawn between Europe and Russia. You have countries that even during the Cold War, like Finland and Sweden, who weren't part of NATO, are joining NATO. But here we have to then look at really again this bad faith that we see from the West and from the Americans, which is so you have this Ukraine after the Soviet Union, which has a significant Russian-speaking population, culturally Russian population. And then they do the Maidan coup. They bring in these neo-Nazi groupings that are part of this coalition. We don't want to say that they were the main people, but they were a significant part. And you change the constitution. They get rid of the Russian language as part of the constitutional rights of the Russian people. You have the civil war starting in 2014. So, yes, I mean, your point is well taken that that this would have been a good situation. But it seems to me that the last thing that the Americans or NATO wanted is a Ukraine where people are living together in peace. They actually were provoking the Russians in many ways with the attacks that they did particularly on the Russian population. And then when the NATO membership was mentioned, again, we are trying to analyze. We're not trying to justify or to agree or disagree with whatever decision was made in Russia. But it is understandable from an analytical perspective if the Russians felt like there was no other option left for them, because they tried all the political options. And it seemed, whether it was the Minsk agreements, whatever, all the other political and diplomatic formulas and ways to deal with this, they saw it was not happening. And maybe this is something going back to the essence of Ukraine. You have this country being created, as you mentioned, and Henry Kissinger mentioned a long time ago, that you have actually two
March
Ukraines.
2014.
Exactly. That you have actually two Ukraines. It's not one country. You have this Ukraine in the West, which is Catholic and much more culturally closer to Poland and that part of Europe. And then you have the East, which is culturally closer to Russia. So what I want to say, because you mentioned these very interesting things. So what you're saying is that essentially we've had this historic turn, this historic event happening, where Russia is separated from Europe, where it separated itself, if we want to analyze it from that perspective, or the Europeans decided with the Americans to separate themselves from the Russians. In Iran, of course, we would say that this was good for us, because then Russia came towards the Asian side, came closer to China, became closer to Iran. As we see, there's very extensive an increase of relations between Iran and Russia in this time. So maybe geopolitically for Asia or Eurasia, this was better. But again, my question is it really in the national interests of a lot of these European countries to have this cordon sanitaire, this hard border? If you look at Hungary, it's trying to have some sort of an independent policy with Russia. It's not, in terms of at least rhetorically and in terms of the way they speak, they are being a little bit more cautious in terms of their relation with Russia. You see even Austria, in many ways, trying to maintain its neutrality within this idea of what's going on, this alliance building, as you say. We see, of course, Serbia, traditionally a natural ally of the Russians, culturally close to the Russians, basically saying that they will not join NATO, no matter what. So again, my question is, as a European, I'm asking you, is it really in many of these countries, particularly those who are closer to Russia, who are maybe dependent in terms of energy and gas and coal and raw materials, is it really in their interest to be in a Cold War and a kind of a non-relation state with Russia?
Let me make two points. First point briefly. We don't have that much time anymore.
No, go ahead.
So to Ukraine. I have to say, Russia was not really fond of neutrality either. So Russia said that they would support a non-NATO membership of NATO, which was credible, I would think. Every Russian president repeated that. But they did not really speak about neutrality. They didn't really. So because that meant the Russian supported militias in the east.
Right. That means Russia would also have to.
Well, Russia would have. It would be an example also for Moldova and Georgia, where you have Russian troops or peacekeepers. So it would be a model for others as well. So the Russians would not really support neutrality. And I have to say, if Ukraine would have become neutral, it could get its territorial sovereignty and territorial integrity back. So it's a unified, you mentioned it's divided. The Russians might have speculated that they want somehow keep the eastern part.
Right.
But if there would be a neutral, would have been a neutral Ukraine, all foreign powers would have to leave, and Ukraine would have the possibility, like Austria, to create its own identity.
In other words, nobody wanted a neutral Ukraine, neither NATO and neither Russia.
Unfortunately, you're right.
Exactly.
Some supported it, like Henry Kissinger and Jamie Oppenheimer as well. They came later as well with the suggestion. So there are some pundits who really thought that it might be the best. But politically, you're correct. Politically, you're correct. So your second point, do the Europeans really want to have this divided Europe? So, and I have to say no. So
exactly.
Because now Putin brought war, and Putin and NATO brought the division of Europe back, like in the Cold War, but that was our starting point. Now it plays out like in this polarization. We have a division of Europe, cordon sanitaire. It even goes to the cultural level. So
it's ridiculous. Some of the sanctions are ridiculous. Sports, culture, opera singers,
arts, science.
It's ridiculous.
To talk to Russian scientists.
We were joking in Iran that it's even worse than the sanctions against Iran, which we thought would never happen.
I don't know whether I could speak on Russian TV like I speak here. So we have this new coordinator on it there, and it will last decades. And the Europeans cannot want to have this.
Exactly.
So they have to think about it, maybe not immediately, but we do have concepts from the history which it could be applied.
So let's talk about that a little.
So I just mentioned two of them.
Right.
So one is because I'm coming from Vienna. We had the Vienna Congress of 1815.
Exactly.
We had
the
Napoleonic Wars, and then the victory powers would sit together, and they would ask France to come to the table a little bit later on as well, and created an order for Europe, which was peaceful first half a century, and then we had this wars of unification, another Crimean war, and but then it lasted another half century, the first war. So it was based on balance of power, at the same time on liberal concepts, common values. I have to say there were all colonial powers. So their interventions in the South, that was permitted.
Exactly.
That was the caveat of this.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But for Europe, it was not such a bad concept to sit together and to avoid another war, which was successful, at least half a century, you can say.
Right.
Then you had this war. So you begin to think about it. Is this type applicable to have a big conference when the war is over, to think about it? We have to somehow bring in Russia back to Europe.
Right.
Like Europe did it after the Second World War with the Marshall Plan. After the First World War, they isolated Germany. And
didn't work.
The result was Hitler.
Exactly.
The Nazis, no?
Exactly. So after World War II, they had the Marshall Plan
And then the second concept I would like to mention is during the height of the Cold War, we had the conference on security and cooperation, the Helsinki Accords of 75. And this was an interesting concept. Height of the Cold War, we had the arms race, of course, we had at the same time the German Ostpolitik and also the the Downpolitik by President Nixon. It was all a global context, of course. But it was the Helsinki Conference. And if you look at the Helsinki documents, they do not mention the words enemy, foe, competitor, rival.
Right.
If you look at the security strategies right now, they're all full of this. And why, and it speaks about common security, cooperative security, and why is it interesting theoretically? So we talked about the security dilemma before. Because security, if we make a decision, security, the other one would react somehow. That would be, I increase my security and the other would feel it offensive. And so the idea was not to increase the security, but to lower the threat level.
Exactly.
A common security is the opposite of the security dilemma.
Right.
Common security was also the idea of the Palme Commission later on.
Right.
Willy Brandt, Palme, Kreisky, so they had this this idea.
Yes.
So this lower the threat and not increase my military capacity.
And they were all social democrats. Olaf Palme, Willy Brandt, Bruno Kreisky.
Yeah. I have to mention this. The one who really prevented a neutral Central Europe in the 50s, according to the Austrian model. There were ideas, Western pundits, not just Stalin. So it was George Kennan as well. Mm-hmm. It was Labour Party leader Hugh Gaitskell. It was the bipartisan initiative, Noland Humphrey from the US. They all said Rabatsky Plan, Polish foreign minister. They wanted to create a neutral Central Europe, nuclear weapon free,
right?
With the inclusion of Germany. Germany would be unified, but it would be also Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary would not part of the Warsaw Pact. So the one who really was opposed it was Konrad Adenauer, etc.
Right.
But I have to say, the father of Austrian neutrality was also a conservative. It was Julius Raab. So
there was
a conflict between Adenauer and Raab. So I had to mention this because you said there were social democrats.
Maybe we can do a program on Austria one day.
No. I know. The time is
so. No, that would be interesting one. We should do it one day.
But I said, Europe, let me summarize, Europe have to think about concepts which go beyond this division. Otherwise, we will have this conflict on sanitaire.
But it seems to me the atmosphere, the public atmosphere, it really is not conductive right now. Any politician who would even mention these things right now, they would, they would hang him up,
That's definitely.
This is a problem, isn't it? I mean, we have a situation where you had this massive propaganda campaign, and it's interesting to me because, Europeans in general, on the average, are much more, conscious, aware, educated, have more information about the world than maybe American public has. So maybe one can understand if the Americans want to, apply this propaganda to their own population because their own population is very ignorant about the world. But the Europeans don't seem to be, are not that ignorant. And yet we see this massive propaganda campaign still going on. the idea that somebody would come out and say, look, we need to talk to the Russians at some point. We can, this is not in our favor. It seems to me this is almost an impossible thing to propose right now as a political figure or as a public figure.
Unfortunately, yes, but it might change if you will feel the effects of the war and if you they will learn about the casualties. So it's they're not different than Americans. If you see casualties all the time and refugees and it over time, if a war goes on for too long, it might change the attitude. But on a global level, because you talk about the European citizens, now we have this war situation, which is a very special situation. And in a war, you have always this with me or against me. You have this
dichotomy.
So there is no place for a complex, as we did, complex analysis.
So we have to start.
Right. But let's just mention one thing that was an poll by the European Council on Foreign Relations, which was taken before the war already. But the question was, if there is a conflict between US and China, it didn't even ask military conflict. It only said conflict.
Right.
What options would you choose? Go with China, go with the US, or stay neutral? So 60 to 65 of the Europeans would say the rather would be stay neutral. Of course, they would not want to side with China, but they would not want to be drawn into a military conflict on the side of a conflict with the US, which is not their own.
Professor, I think we have come to a good conclusion, which is the Austrian model is the best model
for all of
Europe.
I would agree.
That would be the best model. So, Professor, we have about 5 minutes left. If you could please then let's look into the future. We already began talking about in terms of conceptually what could happen, but let's make it a little bit more practical. So you're saying right now the situation is very polarized. It's very hard to begin these conversations in Europe, even though the majority of the people in Europe feel that this is not in their interests. Of course, we have also the winter coming up and this issue of gas and the issue of energy prices. We see in Italy there's already riots, people burning their energy bills in front of the city hall and threatening a boycott of paying their energy bills. We see in Germany a very strange thing happening, people going back to idea of using coal for fuel and going to the forest and cutting down the trees for the firewood. I'm simply saying these things because these are things that are actually happening. I don't want to exaggerate the issue, but it seems to me that this winter is going to be a very interesting winter in Europe because, as you said, the effects are going to be felt maybe in ways that still are not being felt, even though they are being felt. So if you could maybe give us some insight, give us your analysis and your views about this idea of having an alternative vision, a vision that's different than this Cold War and this idea of not having relations with Russia. If you could give us a little bit more practical, what you would suggest practically we should be doing maybe in the next 5, 6, 10 years for this to happen?
Yeah, I have to say, of course, it will be a difficult winter for Europe. It will be not that dramatic as some observers would see it. Of course, the reserves for gas and oil, 85%, they are full. But the problem is the price, because the Europeans are buying oil from gas from the U.S. from Norway, Netherlands, the democratic country of Azerbaijan, and
Algeria.
So I don't want to be cynical now, but it will be expensive, and the prices will be a problem, and we'll have recovered after the pandemic. Now they will fall back in terms of unemployment. Some factories companies will close. So it will be very difficult. And the Europeans seem to be united in the sanctions against Russia. But if it comes to the energy discussion, of course there are pledges that we are still united, but they're not that united, the Europeans. Mm-hmm. They have different interests, and you see it now if you look at the debate on the price cap on Russian gas. So Austria, for example, and others would say, no, that's not feasible. Other European countries would want to do it. So in practical reasons, there might be come out very different things, and the European Union might blame members and other members which are not going along. It might be Hungary and Poland, which maybe it will change in Italy with a new right-wing government as well. Some member states will blame the Commission, and there will be always the excuse, we have to do it on a European level. So we have to speak with one.